philosophy and that, I guess, usefulness. I framed it as a kind of therapeutic way of being treated by philosophy, insofar as philosophy helps us. But that's not necessarily how it always has to be. And I don't know, I mean, not to sidetrack us too much, but you definitely, you attribute this kind of shift in perspective to philosophy. Would you consider it kind of therapeutic in a way? Because it has impacted your work. It's impacted the way that you engage with that. To suggest that it's kind of therapeutic is to say that it has helped you. Obviously, you think it has been for the better, but would you kind of attribute that to a clearing up of something, or do you think this is just a way of operating?
So I really like to use the term clearing up, and I think sometimes when we can recognize when like a problem is kind of being cleared for us, right? You know, and we can see that in its most simple terms, with something very obvious, like perhaps a simple math problem, right? You know, we want to know what 2 + 2 is 4. Okay, like, the structure is kind of complete. And I think sometimes what philosophy helps us do is when we're faced in situations in, you know, our lives where we're not sure really what's going on or what to do, or I think a lot of times, you know, one thing I think I've realized of philosophy is people sometimes think about it in terms, especially in terms of ethical philosophy, in terms of what do we do? Like, okay, what do we do in the situation? What's the procedure? I don't actually think that's usually how we think and operate, though. You know, as we've talked about before, I think people are more immersed in their world. They have a like practical capacity to just do and operate in particular ways. And philosophy becomes more relevant in a kind of reflection. Okay, I've been working with this particular population. I've, you know, kind of found myself here. You know, I didn't sit down beforehand, you know, over my years of my career at the very beginning and be like, do I want to work with this X group of people? Why should I? Why shouldn't I? Da-da-da-da-da, right? I don't, like, while people certainly can take that kind of orientation to problems and decisions, I don't actually think that's usually how people operate. I don't think people are nearly as deliberate as perhaps hardcore philosophers give them like credit for. But where it becomes real is, or more relevant, is in a kind of reflection. Hey, I've been doing this for a little while, and you know, and perhaps I like it, I find it interesting a lot, but like I have come across a problem that I didn't even realize was there before. Okay, now that I'm like kind of in this, I'm already operating this. I'm, the sort of practical aspects of like orienting myself and being capable in this particular world have already sort of shown themselves, already kind of in a happening. But like, here's this more theoretical problem within the context of what I'm doing. And how do I solve that, right? Like, how do I sort of come upon that? And if there isn't a solution, is that a signal that perhaps I'm actually doing something incorrectly or wrong, or could be doing something differently?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I kind of noticed was a commonality between my and your sort of instance that we're talking about here. It's interesting that, first of all, we kind of get into, you know, doing the work that you do and me doing philosophy. We get into it with particular... born into a particular way of doing the problem or doing the work or seeing the problem. You know, we have to help these people or we have to solve these problems. But after a while, you realize that the problems that actually are pressing the problems are the problems that you want to really address with the situation. They come after the fact. They come after you've been in that for a while and you realize that the problems that are really relevant or the problems are the ones that you want to address weren't discernible at the outset. You actually had to become an agent internal to that problem in order to discern it. And it seems like it's very possible that people in the line of work that you do are still kind of caught up in the old problems of, you know, this judicial kind of way of seeing it, whereas you have discerned that and want to address that in a certain way.
And I really like how you, this is like, I think I'm going to have a little like criticism of, you know, professional philosophy right now, which is something that I kind of noticed, which is, you talked about how basically how you have to be caught up in the problem to see. And so, you know, one of the things that I've, you know, I kind of came to realize with, you know, in terms of professional philosophy is there's always been this kind of weird way in which it feels very disjointed or disassociated, not always, but a lot of the times from the real world. And that, like, especially on ethical matters, when you're dealing specifically with ethicists, like, stuff always seems to be kind of missing. Or, like, I shouldn't say always, but stuff seems to be missing a lot of the time. And part of me kind of came from, like, you know, comes to the conclusion, unsurprisingly, that it's like, well, it's very difficult to get the grasp on problems, on life issues, whatever they might be, when you're not out there doing the things or being involved in the things that you are considering. There's something to be said for, like, actually being out in the world, operating in a space, in a particular kind of practice, and doing kind of particular skills and having particular kind of relationships that, like, cannot be replicated by thought alone.
Yeah, it's just armchair ethicism at that point. I mean, you can schematize things and you can insert all your variables and whatnot, but at the end of the day, there are contexts that those reduce that are essential to the problems you're addressing.
You know, this is a product, this comes back to a classic problem that you and I have talked about, many times, which is the issues of theory and practice, right? How it's always, you know, the best laid plans never actually completely fit the situation. Actually, as a little aside, a version of this that I really love is actually from, you know, the German army in World War I, where the officer, one of, like, the sayings of the officer staff was, the best plans only last 1 hour into battle, which was basically saying that you can have very well organized, well laid plans, but the second, you know, the shooting starts, those plans start to fall apart.
Yeah, that, so you kind of open the tin on it and then it starts to expire.
So then it becomes like, and then it, you know, it comes back around, and then it's, instead of relying constantly on, like, a sort of hard, rigid plan, are you trained to be, like, capable in the world in a very general way to understand and deal with problems?
Yeah, are you a competent agent as opposed to a trained ethicist? So one of the things that I wanted to ask about this was, you have had this kind of way of seeing your work, and the way that has illuminated this work is a philosophical sort of bend. I was curious if there was any particular philosopher or philosophies that might have contributed to this, or was this kind of just something that, because I think you're absolutely right that this is a product of reflection. I don't think you can do philosophy without doing reflection. So in a certain sense, this is your own way of solving a particular problem for you. But has there been any philosopher that has given you, not a, I don't want to say a framework, because that's a bit rigid, but a way of helping you see through this problem?
There certainly has, and I'm trying to think back on who would be the best person to bring it, but I think of two, especially when it comes to ethics and dealing with people, there are two, you know, sort of schools that I think really have affected me the most, and that would definitely be, like, what we brought up before, Kant's deontology, and a kind of, there's something to be said for a kind of rigid sense of doing good, right? Where it's just like a commitment to helping people, especially within the context of a commitment to helping a person who is suffering, is never the wrong decision, right? That's like that, and that kind of like it's a good in itself. It's a duty that like people have, and like there's never, you know, you can never, even if the person is completely terrible, being like kind to people is not ever wrong, right? So you know, even if one is sitting, you know, perhaps sitting in a, you know, a room across from someone as bad as, say, a serial killer, whoever it might be, to be dramatic, you know, to sit there with them and still be, obviously one needs to keep oneself safe, that's a different issue, but we're talking about all other things being equal, to be able to sit there and be respectful and, you know, be kind is not, like, is frankly, like, the right thing to do. Like, that doesn't mean you have to be, like, friends with people. It doesn't mean you have to, like, do extra stuff above and beyond them. But this sort of, like, basic, essential sense of, like, a general kindness and respect and, like, a goodness towards, you know, all persons is, I never think... Yes, exactly. That's what I think is a good approach. The other side of it, too, is going to another... I wish I had more obscure, interesting people to talk about, but going more to, like, Aristotle and a world of virtue ethics, wherein, basically, operating both in unethical terms, but more generally, and this actually gets more into, like, some later people that I'll bring up as well, but that it's all kind of a skill. That skill is essential. That habit is essential. That, like, you know, people don't just magically behave one way one day and then one way the next. And communities don't regularly operate magically one way and then a completely opposite way the next. You know, these are things that are developed over time, and they become to be seen as innate only because of their consistent replication, where they become their durability, they become naturalized. And obviously Aristotle has a particularly ethical component, but I also think talking about people like Heidegger and some other philosophers like Dreyfus and people like that, where like these sorts of skills and, you know, the practices that they're a part of are very, like, that is actually what our world is effectively made up of, is a world of practices that are made up of skills, and those practices have particular ends and goals. Oftentimes they're not simple, but in fact they're very complex, and that people, you know, a big part of perhaps life in general is it sounds mechanical, but it's, I guess you'd say, it is operating in the world. Like, I think you would know what that means. I hope our listeners kind of understand that. But it seems very almost like a platitude to say. But like being able to cope, you know, in the world, being able to like wake up and just like, you know, be an effective human being, right? I just like have developed in such a way that I know how to operate in particular situations. I know how to use certain tools. I know how to have certain interactions. I'm capable in doing all those things. And over time, I continue to perfect those practices.
I find it interesting that Kant and the kind of deontological project has influenced you as much as it has. But I think that's makes complete sense, not only for the work that you do, but that you do philosophical kind of ethics in your work, that you want to apply it, and that's a kind of unconditional thing in a sense. It's interesting to tie in Aristotle and Heidegger, though, both in terms of, you know, practices and whatnot. Aristotle does have a lot to say about ethics as a kind of practice that one gets better at, and I think that is he's often understood in that way, but I think because Aristotle is understood in as neighbors to modern ethical theories, that gets overlooked, and you might be compared to things like consequentialists, when that's not really what he's That's not what his contribution to ethics is in the, you know, in our contemporary philosophical period. But, and also just to comment on the Heideggerian bit as well, I thought that that was kind of the meat of what you were saying when you were describing your experience of working and doing your work philosophically, which is this illumination of a situation that you once found yourself immersed in, again, kind of born into. You know, you weren't born into your job, but I'm using that as a metaphor for finding yourself as given in a situation, and then all of a sudden the articulated structure of that becomes clear to you in some way. I mean, for Heidegger, it becomes that way through a breakdown. I mean, most people, I mean, the most common reading of the first parts of Being and Time are the hammer, you know, the hammer breaks down, and then all of a sudden that's when you start discerning structures, because you have to no longer cope with the practice, you have to cope with coping with the practice in a way. So it's interesting. I think that plays into a similar situation with philosophy as well, where you start to have this breakdown of philosophy is no longer doing what it's supposed to do. You know, I thought philosophy was going to answer these problems, but when answering, you know, or when solving Cartesian dualism doesn't actually mean anything to me, and philosophy starts losing its grip, and we start to question, okay, well, what is philosophy? What are we even doing here? What meaning does it have for me? And we start to think about its structure. That's when we start illuminating the overall scope of the world. Again, to go back to being in the world. So I thought that was the interesting sort of Heideggerian bit to what you were saying.
You know, we've been talking a lot about the practicalities of philosophy and how it's actually useful. I do think, though, that there's room for things that are less obviously practical than like particular ethical considerations. This kind of sense of being aware of one's thrownness, for lack of a better way of saying it, being, you know, being able to pause, look around and be like, whoa, this is just, in the most general way, this is weird. What's going on here? And I think that one of the great things about Heidegger and the phenomenological school that he comes from is this really getting at this idea of practices, and particularly background practices. The term ritual, ritualistic, is used in archaeology, is a very general catch-all for basically practices. They might be food-related rituals, they might be rituals, social rituals, they might be religious or spiritual-type rituals. The idea is basically, you know, we found items, we found a space that is ritualistic in some way. It was used in some particular way for some particular reason or reasons, and that's pretty much all we know. And in a way, like, life is, to me, at least when you look around in one's life world, it's really, life is this ritualistic process, this sort of repetitive structure of repeating the similar sorts of actions and interactions over and over and over again, and being capable or skilled in doing those things. This is from Hubert Dreyfus's Background Practices, and which is a series of essays by his. But this is actually from the Introduction, which is by Mark A. Rathwell, who's another relatively well-known modern Heideggerian scholar. He says, what's the difference between a skill and a practice? Skills, one might say, enable us to participate in a practice fluidly, but a practice is not reducible to a skill. It is rather the standing condition of the possibility of acting skillfully in a particular domain. To be more precise, a practice is a complex structure that sustains actions, that sustains skills. So he says the practice of soccer is a complex structure that involves A, section part A, embodied agents over whom are distributed the broad variety of skills involved in playing soccer, staging soccer matches, skills for dribbling, passing, heading, shooting the ball, skills for tackling, skills for running the offside trap, and so on. In acquiring these skills, agents also acquire the ability to perceive and respond appropriately to situations. So a lot of stuff seems kind of platitudinal, but basically it's, you know, the physical and mental capacity to do the things that we understand to be soccer, right? Just like in my own work, there's a physical and mental capacity to deal with people in distress, you know how to contact emergency service, for example, know how to be, you know, kind or use a particular tone of voice in a particular situation, right? All these things are very practical, small little things that go into working with people with, you know, diverse needs, whatever you want to call it, right? But then there's a second part, which is the, you know, physical stuff, the concrete equipmental contacts that include soccer, pitches, uniform, boots, balls, whistles, flags, goals, posts, and so on. Each item of equipment has its own specific style, dimensions, features, in virtue of the fact that it is part of the practice of soccer. So then, obviously, there's the physical stuff, right?
With the ball, yeah, the soccer. There's the what we call the objective world of it, in a way.
Yeah, there's the things that you need. Just like, you know, if you and I were to, like, let's take something even simpler, chess. Obviously, we have to have the mental disposition to be able to play chess. You and I need to know the rules. We need to both have this kind of motivation to win. If we sit down and, you know, and you're like, I'm someone who doesn't care about winning. I don't care about playing games. I know how chess works. I just don't want to do it. Well, that's not going to work. But we also need a chess board, right? We need pieces. We need a board. We need to have the stuff to actually play chess. And then finally, the last section is the social component. The socially shared vocabulary for talking about soccer, socially constituted roles like a goalie, striker, midfield, manager, a referee, a linesman, promoter, and a sense of good and bad, exciting and boring, and a proper and improper ways of performing soccer activities. And so this finally comes to this element that, you know, we're talking about these sort of how life has this practical, that life is full of these background practices, that is what is kind of makes up our life world, and that these are always about in relation to others, right? None of these practices actually exist in isolation. They wouldn't make sense if they were isolated. For one of the most obvious ones is you would have no language for a practice that is isolated. If you were doing something that nobody else ever knew about, that nobody else understood, that like that nobody else was ever a part of in any kind of way, either like with what we were actually doing or historically in terms of doing the same sort of activities, then what kind of activity would you even be doing?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine how that could even come about. I mean, you would have to somehow divorce your understanding of whatever has spontaneously generated beyond the bounds of language from language. If you can talk about it, then it's kind of sourced in it in that way. I mean, you can sort of metaphorically understand it, but I think that's about as far as unintelligible as something could be if you have to make this leap of insight to get there. But it's always possible to get there. But yeah, no, it can never be completely untethered from this sort of system that the world is. Again, you're right, they can't be disjointed. They can be understood in these kind of general terms, you know, the social is distinct from the objective because, you know, you can bump up against things like soccer balls and bleachers, but you can't bump up against the role of a promoter or the, you know, the sports fandom in a way. Those are those are distinctions you can draw as a philosopher, but in terms of the actual practice of soccer, they're very interrelated. I mean, fans of soccer sit on soccer bleachers. Where else are they going to sit? They might stand in front of their TVs while they watch it, but, you know, they exist as this pair. You wouldn't have a TV if you didn't have people who could see. TVs wouldn't have been invented without perceptive beings. I mean, that's, now we're flying into complete generalities about TV and media, but that is an important part to make, an important point to make. I mean, you need two dancers to make the dance in a way. A person can dance on their own.
Despite sometimes feeling like we're a soul trapped in, you know, a body that's completely isolated from the world, in fact, everything about our existence points to and relies upon others. And I think that was, I think there's this real tendency, at least early on, philosophical thinking, especially, you know, going back to Descartes and his, you know, problem or perhaps his error, that, you know, that we're this sort of isolated, you know, soul substance, you know, this mind trapped in a body that's kind of isolated from the world, that you're alone and you're alone with your thoughts. And initially, on a very light level of reflection, that's a very easy way to think about it. And it's one that people get trapped in all the time. It's the stuff that existential crises are kind of made of. Perhaps it's the bedrock of them. As you've kind of hinted at throughout the show, even the possibility of those sorts of quandaries, of those problems, of those anxieties, imply other people.
And not just in this sense of like, okay, well, someone had to transmit the idea to you. Sure, that's easy to understand. But that those problems are only possible in a situation of multiplicity, of multiple people who can communicate these things. Language is not, like, language only arises because there's other people you need to talk with. I mean, that gets a bit distant from Descartes, but that is just to say that this hyper-atomism of the individual, it's a much more radical idea than most people think. People take it to be very commonplace, but if you actually examine the way that we go about existing in the world, this image becomes much more, I don't want to say untenable, because we live our lives according to it. It actually works really well.
It becomes very alien from the world that you actually live in.
So you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been your host, Brandon, and been joined by Hale. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM, talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors, and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, mad, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.